Today's episode of the Crack Podcast is sponsored by Squarespace. Whether you're starting a new business or launching a creative project, Squarespace gives you everything you need to make your next move into an awesome reality. So start your free trial today at squarespace.com and enter offer code CRACKED to get 10% off your first purchase plus a free domain with the purchase of an annual plan. Great news for me and other fans of with special guest Lauren Lapkus. Lauren is back with a brand new lineup of guests to host her show. So listen to new episodes of with special guest Lauren Lapkus every Friday on Earwolf, iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast app. Hello, the internet, and welcome to another episode of the Cracked Podcast. My name is Jack O'Brien. I'm the editor-in-chief of Cracked, and this week we're talking to the hosts of one of my favorite podcasts, The Dollop, which is a show in which each episode, Dave Anthony reads a really well-researched story from U.S. history to his co-host, Gareth Edwards. Hey, guys, correction alert. Weird to be inserting a correction this early, but I said Gareth Edwards, and it is Gareth Reynolds. Gareth Edwards is the director of Rogue One and Godzilla, and I am a very stupid person. Gareth Reynolds is the hilarious comedian who you will be hearing from in this episode. End correction. Back to the episode. So each episode, different story from U.S. history. And we're going to talk to them mainly about two incredible episodes that they did. One about Enron and another, which is actually a double episode, about the Boston busing race riots and how both of those stories relate to the modern world. Now, Enron is a story I'd obviously heard of before The Dollop, but I guess I just had no idea how surreal and just completely bonkers it actually was. But I'd actually never heard of the Boston busing crisis of the 1970s. If you're like me, first of all, hold on to your butts, but it's almost like there's a specific playbook that Americans didn't realize we were following this past election. So I asked them each for the most surprising overarching lesson that they've learned about U.S. history, having about 250 episodes under their belt. And real quick, up top, I want to tell you a couple of my most surprising things I've learned about U.S. history from their podcast, and also being the editor-in-chief of a site that writes about some of the same stories or very similar stories. One, I've learned that American history is generally just way more violent than we give it credit for. And I don't mean wars or serial killers. I mean just daily run-of-the-mill violence. There's one really good episode about the first firefighters in American history. And it turns out firefighters in New York and Philadelphia used to be like rival gangs that would just like beat the shit out of each other and blocked each other from getting to the fires they were supposed to be fighting. We've talked before on the site about the fact that the most popular sport in the South prior to the 20th century was a type of no-holds-barred wrestling where I guess the best way to give you an idea of how it worked is by telling you that a popular move was pulling your opponent's eyeball out. And other popular strategies involved biting noses and fingers and lips off of people's face. In the article where we mentioned it, we have this quote from an English minister named Charles Wood Mason, who is referring to this sport in a 1760 sermon when he said, "I would advise you when you do fight not to act like tigers and bears as these Virginians do, biting one another's lips and noses off and gouging one another, that is thrusting one another's eyes and kicking one another on the cods to the great damage of many a poor woman." And just another scene I love from this sort of backyard wrestling of yesteryear. One fighter was told he'd kind of done badly by someone. Someone was like, "You sucked, man." And he turned around and said, "Did I suck?" as he pulled his opponent's eyeball from his pocket. There's another great dollop where I learned about America's just shocking everyday violence, about a group called the Gopher Gang, who were a gang from Hell's Kitchen at the beginning of the 20th century, who used to wear the jackets of cops that they'd beaten up as part of their uniform, like they were animal skins they had successfully hunted. And at one point in Dave's telling of the story on the Dollop episode, six members of the Gopher Gang happen upon a shootout between 100 members of two totally different gangs and, you know, decide to pull out their guns and get involved because they like a good fight. But just the fact that this was a time when you could be walking down the streets of New York City and stumble into 100 criminals shooting at each other, it just generally puts our scariest, most brazen criminals to shame. Reading through American history, you just realize over and over again that the stuff our 24-hour news channels freak out about ain't shit. The fights between the firemen on the way to massive fires would give the people at Good Morning America such a powerful orgasm, it would kill them. Another thing that you see over and over that we'll kind of touch on is that you really can't trust the handful of people with money and power to do what's in the best interest of people who work for them, and just generally the 99.9% of the population that doesn't have as much money as them, they will fuck us. Unfortunately, another thing you realize in relation to this is that we're at sort of the most defenseless point we've ever been at with regards to being protected from capital, the billionaires with the money. Over and over again, while listening to dollops, I find myself being like, thank God for the unions, because if they didn't exist, the robber barons and billionaires would literally be eating the poor. They would have taken Swift's A Modest Proposal as literal instruction manual. And unfortunately, we're at sort of an all-time low for union memberships, and our trust that capitalism would sort of sort itself out has gotten greater and greater. That's what I grew up thinking. Anyways, capitalism works. Greed's good. Yeah, when capitalism's allowed to sort everything out on its own, when there's like this unregulated, no holds barred version of capitalism, you actually don't get any of the American values that people associate with the American dream. We've come to a place where statistics say that most developed countries in Europe are better at the American dream than America is in terms of upward mobility, because we've let capital run rampant for the past 35 years. Anyways, it's an interesting conversation that I hope you enjoy and learn something from. I'll be dropping back in here and there to offer a little more context, and then back at the end for some footnotes. Talk to you then. I'm joined by Michael Swaim, who is a video writer and editor at Cracked. And we are thrilled to be joined by Dave Anthony and Gareth Reynolds from The Dollop, the history podcast.
Welcome, guys. Thank you so much for being here.
Hello.
Hi. Is this okay? Yes, I'm Dave.
I'm Gareth.
I'm a huge fan of your show. For people who aren't familiar with it, basically, Dave, you read an incredibly well-researched story from American history.
Yeah, usually well-researched.
I'm always really, really impressed.
Are we asking about how good the show is? Or are we focusing on... Because you talked...
I want to summarize it and then get into stuff.
I definitely want to know how you put it together, because it's certainly... yeah, there's plenty of podcasts where they read a Wikipedia entry. What you read seems way more robust than that.
So I go by... there's books, and then there is a lot of newspaper articles that I research from the past. And then just,
do you have like LexisNexis or what do you
use? I use newspapers.com mostly.
Oh, okay.
And that usually gets me what I need. Because the funny thing about newspapers back then is they were all just swapping stories, right? So you can find the same stories in all of the newspapers.
Right. Not like now where everyone just originates their own content.
Right. Just makes shit up. Yeah.
But it's funny because back then it would be like, you know, a week later someone would post the same story.
Right, right.
Post. How many likes did our article get, Debbie? How many likes are we up to? Any shares? Huh? Who's commenting?
Retweets take a week to process. You got to press the printer and all that shit. Yeah.
Twitter publications.
But then there's also, you know, like more professional papers that professors should crank out and stuff like that and research that I can find here and there. And then some stuff will take me months. And other stuff will take me a day, you know, it just comes really quick. But there's some stuff, like there's some stories now that I've been researching for 3 or 4 months.
Oh, wow.
That hopefully when I drop them, they're, you know, like big bombs kind of.
Yeah.
And then I have, there's in particular one, Christine, who lives in Portland. She's a grad student and she just is super helpful and loves to research. So she helps me out a lot. And then there's a few other people that help me out, but for the most part, it can be a lot of time. Some of them I just come together.
Yeah, months, that's crazy.
Really quickly. But when I do the modern ones, Enron is one.
Right.
Ferguson, Iraq War, those were much harder.
Yeah.
And I'm doing one of those now.
Oh, okay.
My modern one now.
And so you read these really well-researched versions of history, and then Gareth, you legit come in without any idea of...
No idea what he's about to drop on me.
Right.
Yeah.
And then just kind of react organically. And
then I just do, I do what I would do if someone told me that without microphones, which is just try to bring people to life and be like, what the fuck?
Yeah, so I wanted to kind of, at least at the beginning here, focus on two subjects from somewhat recent episodes that just kind of blew me away as someone also like yourself coming in and not really knowing much. Like I had obviously heard of Enron. I actually didn't really know about the Boston busing riots.
Nor I.
All right, just want to give you a little context for some of the stuff we're about to talk about. So the Boston busing riots and just generally the conflict started with the housing being torn down, as we'll mention, but it first became about the schools when the NAACP called a meeting where they said, our schools are drastically underfunded compared to even the schools in the equally poor but white Irish neighborhoods of Southie. And all they asked for at this meeting was for the white school officials, a lady named Louise Day Hicks, to admit that there was an imbalance that needed to be addressed. They pointed out that, you know, when there's a leak in the roof of the school library, it doesn't get fixed if it's falling on the heads of black children, only if there's a chance that it's going to fall on white kids' heads. And they were right. This was true at that point. The school board and leadership were white people, some of them from Southie. So the NAACP calls this meeting just to ask that the inequality be acknowledged as a starting point, and the school board and politicians in attendance instead say, we don't agree that the problem is underfunding, and in fact, we think the problem is that you, black parents, are worse parents than us and provide our teachers with less disciplined students. Which obviously isn't true and enrages the black community. And I would stop here and just say that one of the things that was pointed out in the dollop was that the schools in the black community were predominantly taught by white teachers at that time because the school infrastructure was white, so that's just who they gave jobs to. So in 1999, a number of years ago, but 25 years after the events we're talking about here, I volunteered at an elementary school in Dorchester, which is one of the nearly all black parts of Boston. Boston's still shockingly segregated. And the class I sat in on was taught by an elderly white lady with a thick Boston accent, and the way she dealt with this class of fifth graders was excessively negative, just only had one tone, and it was yelling at them to the point that I remember one time a student got a math question right, and she was just like so used to yelling at them that she just went, "No! Why don't you think?" at him, and I had to like take him aside later and tell him he was right, but imagine what that does to you. You get the right answer and your teacher screams at you for being wrong. That kind of fucks with your entire foundation of your reality. And anyways, it was such a traumatizing experience. One of my friends who I did the project with, who's just like a beautiful, empathetic person, Dave Jenkins, never got past it. He went to Harvard, devoted a lot of his life to helping kids in those communities in Boston, and I went on to edit dick jokes for a living. Anyways, back to the busing story. The NAACP fights and fights just to have the inequality of the schools acknowledged, and finally a judge comes up with this solution that they would try integrating the schools, the rationale being the only way they can get the white administration to give a shit about their schools is to put the administrator's white kids in those schools and send some of the black students to Southeast schools to even the score just a tiny bit. And it's an incredibly unpopular decision in Southie. And then on the first day of school, Southie just loses its collective shit. We're going to be referring to an election that parallels the Trump-Clinton election and a Time Newsweek article that parallels Clinton's basket of deplorables statement. Basically, a woman representing Southie, Louise Day Hicks, whose background was on the school board, ran for mayor, represented the anti-busing cause, and her campaign slogan was the highly coded, "You know where I stand." And the coverage of her by the media was just incredibly unflattering. There's a Newsweek article where they describe her as a troll and are just incredibly condescending to her and her supporters. Which, I mean, looking back, is very similar to how the media was with Trump country in our recent election. The one difference between the two elections being that in Boston, the anti-establishment person was a woman and she lost, whereas Trump was the anti-establishment in our election and he actually won. Anyways, the violence that resulted once they started busing black kids into South Boston, Southie kids to North Boston, was insane. Mobs of white students and their parents locked the buses as they pulled into Southie with the black students and like threw bananas and watermelons at them, and eventually bottles and bricks. And, you know, cops were hit by those bricks and killed. There were just like 12-hour long street fights in the hallways between black students and white students. And one white student was stabbed. A Haitian guy who took a wrong turn into Southie was dragged out of his car because of the color of his skin and nearly beaten to death. And the schools were shut down with weeks left in the semester because the violence and rioting was just too intense. Anyways, that should give you enough context for what we're talking about here and why I can't believe this isn't one of the first stories I learned in U.S. history classes. All right, back to the episode.
Like, yeah, that one's kind of one no one talks about. It just kind of washed over. And oh, yeah, and then there were some people got upset about busing, and then you move on.
It's a huge race riot, like the middle of
Boston. It's like
an
architected race riot.
In the 70s that, yeah, I had heard of all the race riots starring black people, like the Watts one and, you know, the L.A. riots. You hear all about those. But
and this was arguably the only one the president signed off on.
Right.
Endorsed this riot.
So the idea was that there was a forced integration of the Boston school districts, and in particular, the South Boston school, which is where the people from Southie, so the Irish schools are. And was it Roxbury?
Yeah.
Which was a predominantly black school. And Boston is one of the most segregated places in the world.
Yeah, by country, you know, there's the Italians in one area and Irish in another. It's kind of the same way in Rhode Island, although I don't know if it is still the same, but it was back then.
Yeah.
All my knowledge of Boston comes from Fallout 4, which takes place in Boston thousands of years in the future.
That's as good as living there.
Yeah,
but what's amazing is even in that universe, thousands of years in the future, there are like mutants who would be like, don't go to Southie, though. Yeah. Like, literally, it's the area you're not supposed to go into.
Yeah,
in the game,
and the Southie mutants are like, we don't like the green mutants. Yeah, they're cheap.
Yeah, we actually had a guy on who is a historian who has this whole theory about there being like 11 different nations in America. Have you talked to him?
I know, but I've heard about this.
Yeah. And Boston is
its own
Yankee-dom kind of. It's different from New York. I always kind of associated those as like kind of part of the same metropolis, right?
Sure.
But Yankee-dom are like these sort of stiff people from England who came for religious freedom and were super racist. And so like you get these really segregated parts of town. Whereas like, you know, I've lived in both places and I hadn't really thought about it, but Boston is incredibly segregated. I do want to talk about Boston busing because that's something. Yeah. Like I said, I didn't know it was a thing. I don't think a lot of people knew it was a thing. It was essentially people in the black parts of Boston, which there were specifically zoned black parts of Boston, and they had worse schools. Like they just
it was like
terrible.
Almost unbelievable. Like you can't even imagine how much worse they were. And a lot of the Southeast controlled the school board and they just weren't funding them. They had science classes with no microscopes, and then over in the South Boston, they had all microscopes.
Right.
So it was just stuff like that. And once the busing started, all of a sudden, the black schools got microscopes.
Right, exactly.
Because that's exactly what they wanted. So it's this weird idea of like, well, you have to sort of bus people in, but the kids that are getting bused in are living through hell, but the greater good, right, is that everything gets equalized. But unfortunately, you're sacrificing children.
Which was the craziest part to me, because I feel like even by that time in American history, there's a few cultural things 100% of this crazy map agrees with, or other than psychopaths. And one was like, if you have a political issue, you fight it out with their parents. But these people are like, no, we go to the school and we fuck up these kids who have the misfortune of being told they need to attend this school.
Right. And be upset that their kids are being driven away in buses, which didn't happen because they didn't let their kids get on the buses.
There's like this incredible photograph of like a guy from Southie stabbing, I think, a black politician with
he's just a guy walking. Oh, he was like a business owner.
He's just a business owner walking up to the courthouse, but he's stabbing him with an American flag. It's like one of the most, I don't know, vivid images and like just incredible political images you've ever seen. It's like if reality suddenly became a political cartoon and you never see it. It's similar to the thing with San Jose. Like you never hear about that riot in San Jose because it was Jackie Coogan instead of, you guys talked about a lynching that happened in San Jose.
Yeah, you don't hear about that at all. Well, just like the fact that there were pro-slavery riots. There's stuff we just pretend like didn't happen.
Yeah, the deadliest riot in American history happened in Manhattan and was Irish people basically being like, we think black people should have to fight in the Civil War if we're going to.
So let's go hang them from light posts.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's crazy. That funny, Gareth.
You know, see, that's the thing is we do. It's so funny. Like I found a story from Tulsa about a black, I think he was like 18 or something, getting lynched. And it was the usual, that black man raped me or whatever, which is usually never true. Mm-hmm. And so the whole town lynched this kid and killed him. And then after I did that story, I'm like, well, you can do that because it's an isolated thing. But people are like, do Tulsa. Do the thing where they killed hundreds of black people in Tulsa. I'm like, yeah, not funny. You can find nothing. Like, there's tragedy that you can make funny and make a point. But the stuff where they just annihilated a town, like
and
Rosewood.
Erased it from history.
And erased it.
Yeah.
There's nothing funny about it because it's the definition of ethnic cleansing.
It's legitimately Stalin-esque. They're just like erasing people from photographs.
Which, as a historical event, is certainly good for us to remember, but maybe not like on the dollop or the crack podcast. Yeah. There's other beats that can do like the actual Holocaust.
That's on Dan Carlin.
Yeah, let Dan Carlin have
Dan
that.
Dan Carlin needs to fucking get his shit together.
Do Tulsa.
The Southeast story really reminded me of the current political environment, sort of the way that folks from Trump country were sort of getting mad at immigrants and other people who had it worse than them. White people from rural America who had kind of lost their jobs and been generally shit on by the past 20 years of American history. You know, rather than getting mad at the people who are making the decisions that were doing the shitting on them, they kind of take it out on...
Although I would say they did take it out on the people who made those decisions, didn't they?
So in Boston?
As well.
No, in the whole country. So Trump got elected because Republicans didn't. And she didn't get elected because everyone was mad at the parties that be.
Yeah, that's
right? True. So true. It was a great, like, fuck you to the political establishment, many of who didn't even hear the fuck you, which is pretty loud.
And as you pointed out in the episode, it's a crazy microcosm. Like, it's the most apt analogy to the Trump thing ever, except that she lost. But I just listened to the episode, and the part that really struck me is where Gareth, you're literally like shouted out, basket of deplorables, because they're attempt to fight the liberal fight or like the anti or the pro-busing fight was an article just saying like this ugly dumb troll leads this voting block of ignorant rednecks, don't worry about it. And that's not a good tactic.
I mean, that's right. It was Time Magazine, right? They did the exact same thing they do to Trump, and it just got her people fired up. And they called her stupid, and they called her all these, she's backwards. She all this. It was the exact same thing, just in Boston. And it was amazing. The reaction was like, no, we love her. Like, they didn't back down at all. It didn't change anybody's mind.
She's our troll. I have to pass that bridge to get home from work. Can't piss off the troll.
That was definitely the hardest I laughed in that episode, was the run about her being a troll.
Yeah.
Like an actual troll.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing, that the whole thing is based on appearance, and then they will just shit all over someone's appearance.
Right.
Yeah, they really did.
And the other aspect that struck me is you guys were talking about how there was that powder keg situation that a lot of us feel paved the way for a Trump presidency, of like there was a 40% unemployment rate among like poor white males. So there were a bunch of like disenfranchised, angry white dudes just free with lots of free time. It would just struck me that Trump, I think, famously like said that the unemployment rate is at 40%.
But some are saying 42%, but you could tell he was just getting excited. That didn't happen. He just could hear them getting louder at like 30, and he was like, come on, baby, these go to 11.
He's charting
42%.
New number territory.
90%. 100, the 110% you always hear about.
Yeah, but it's almost as if, even if it doesn't exist, he's aware of what conditions help him thrive, and he wants
He went out there and said everything's fucked up, and the Democrats had a convention and they were like, we're awesome, everything's great. And you're like, not to the people who think it's fucked up and are living in their cars or had their house taken away. Yeah, so she definitely addressed, in the Boston episode, she definitely addressed all those old school sort of fears that existed. But, you know, it's the same thing as this election. A lot of people are like, it's just racism and it's just, you know, sexism, and it never is, because in Boston, they weren't just all of a sudden racist. Like, they got fucked for 10 years by the people building the city and wiping out neighborhoods and putting in expensive houses and just fucking them. And then what do? They punch the guy nearest them, right? They attack the closest thing.
And that's a big recurring theme on your show that I very much appreciate, that I think surfaces in a lot of American history, is just, God, that's a trick we fall for constantly. Yeah. It's like, it's so hard, in the same way that it's harder to feel bad about shooting a missile at someone on the other side of the world it's hard to be like, no, the fucking person who's to blame for this shit is 1,000 miles away in an office.
Tough. Yeah.
You just go out and punch your neighbor in the face. You know?
It's right. tough to fathom. It's tough to fathom the system being completely corrupted, and it's easier to just think that it's a person's fault that you can see.
Right.
Which is like what I think we've compared, or I've said is like the Jerry Springer thing, where like these two girls are sleeping with one dude. They bring out the second girl. The dude's on stage. Both girls don't beat the shit out of the dude. They fight each other. And you're like, the dude's the problem. The dude's the liar. He's the problem. You're both fine. And right. probably have a lot more in common than you think.
Yeah. You, at one point, I think you got exasperated, Gareth, and you were like, why don't we just, that's we know where like these you. Fucking guys live. Like, why don't we just go to where they live, yeah, kick down I'm their getting, fucking fences. Yeah. And, I mean, Whitey Bulger did that kind of it,
sort of.
Like at a certain point, Whitey Bulger figures into this story. He so there's a judge who lit, had kind
it's
of.
It's always a bad start to a Whitey Bulger tale. Yeah. So there's a judge
right. that crossed him. Yeah. For some reason, yeah. no one will ever understand.
Judge didn't like it.
But the judge who ordered the busing lived in a suburb where they weren't busing. And so Whitey Bulger went to that school district and firebombed the elementary school so that those
then
kids had to be bussed
away.
They
had to bus those kids. Yeah. I mean, he made his point, right. and it worked for right. him.
But that's the ripple effect of bad decision-making.
Right.
It's like it's going to push further horrible decisions.
None of this happens if they're funding the black schools the way they are the white
yeah,
schools.
Yeah, exactly.
I know.
At the
and
end of the day.
The thing they can't even say. They can't do that.
And even after all of the shit that they kicked up in response to the busing, there was, you know, all these race riots. Yeah, like you said, at the end of the first semester, the black families were like, what the fuck is with all these textbooks that yeah. are coming home with these kids? Yeah. Holy shit, you guys have textbooks? That's yeah. incredible.
You're lousy with microscopes now. You got yeah. microscopes falling out of your pockets.
Don't tell any of the other black families. right. Week, okay?
Right.
Mum's the word.
It was just, they were getting so badly screwed.
That's the theme of the dollop in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
It's called a pencil. They just showed it to us. It's amazing.
Right. We've been using blood after we rip our fingernails out. Chalk? What? Board? What's chalk?
It's the old thing, right? That the history is written by the victors, so the people who are writing right. the textbooks aren't going to be the ones like, and then we killed Tulsa.
Yeah. Right. Like, right. Yeah, that doesn't get told.
They teach the Holocaust in German schools.
What?
Yeah, they teach kids. They teach
I don't
kids.
Believe that.
It's true. They teach a lot, yeah. of, a lot of schools teach kids about the Holocaust.
Well, that's because they lost.
True.
Well, no, I do.
But they
well,
teach it because, I mean, it might be because it's recent, but also when you hear stuff on our podcast,
enough,
it's recent
enough and there's a tipping point. I like to think, like, 9/11, we don't think of the terrorists as the victors in a global sense, or we hope they won't be. That would be weird. But
I think if you
we'll remember it for quite some time.
If
anyway.
You step back and looked at what's happened since 9/11, they've gotten everything they wanted.
Yeah. No, that was the...
The I mean, terrorists got everything they
yeah,
wanted.
Yeah, we were like, there's more gold down this hole, sir!
yeah.
Oh, no!
Well, that in that situation, that's true. Victor's kind of even a hard term, because, like, you get things you want politically. Many of you are also dead or hiding
right.
in a
yeah,
cave.
People die, but...
Victory is an interesting concept.
Well, it yeah. depends what your goal is.
Right,
like, if your
course,
goal is
yeah.
to have all those... I can't think of the name, but the head of Egypt and Gaddafi and these guys all right. overthrown. Well, yeah. it's working, and to have the... Yeah. U.S. economy in chaos that's working, yeah. you know, as soon as Saudi Arabia falls, then they'll be like, okay, we yeah. did it. And,
they
that, and that's
a,
totally common.
Yeah.
They wanted a religious war and we were like, religious war? That's so barbaric. And then like 15 years later, we're like, religious war! like just because
well,
they fucking fired the
similar,
first shot.
Like the Whitey Bulger thing we just right. talked about, right? You just keep pushing until... The, even the reasonable side loses their patience and goes, let's just fucking riot about
well,
it,
that's
motherfucker.
That's the beauty of being the underdog in those situations.
You can destabilize so much more easily.
There's nothing off limits. Yeah. yeah, in hypernormalization, when they show you how suicide bombing started, I was like, oh. wow, that is so... I never even thought, how did suicide bombing start? But then obviously one day, some guys just like, you know, we'll use it.
As a weapon.
Yeah, we'll use it yeah. as a Assad. Weapon, and then it's an adopted, you know, and then this is a tactic that's out in the world.
It's fascinating. Assad, Assad was a,
Daddy
a secular,
Assad,
a secular
Papa
leader.
Assad, I call him.
And
he
had problems with the U.S. being in Lebanon, and at the same time, you had the Islamic Revolution going on, so you had guys who had killed themselves for religion. So he imported them and had them blow themselves up. There's your first suicide bombing. And then it went out of control. Because once you started doing it, it was the, you know, it's kind of hard to control suicide bombers.
It's a Pandora's bomb, we call it.
And I'm sure that's part of the process is just feeding them rage memes and rage memes until they're like, fuck it. Yeah. Strap me up. Yeah. Let's go.
No, I heard ISIS is mostly memes.
It's very mean.
A lot of memes.
Well, you talked
bars.
In this week's
a lot of monkey
episode,
bars and memes.
And I thought it was very interesting, actually. The more apt Trump comparison than Nazism is 1984. Like, Alex talked about how the 2 minutes hate is, like, literally...
The 2 minute hate, yeah.
It goes way back, the idea of just feeding someone images that make that demographic angry until they're so mentally destabilized, they go like, who do you want me to fucking punch in the face? Because I'm ready.
Yeah.
We've known how to do that to people for a long time.
Yeah, but now we can do it to them individually.
And we have an internet box where, you at home can do it alone in your little box and just make your whole life that.
Well,
it's bizarre.
And your box is almost that. It's like the Clockwork Orange Man. But, I mean, it, truly, like, Facebook is nothing more than an echo chamber. For the most part. And so, like, when people, either side, it's not the place to get your information.
No, it's when you read about who was reading fake news, it's pretty evenly split between Hillary people and Trump people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Fuck. Guys. And gals. NCAA March Madness has just begun, and if you're like any of the other dopes in the cracked office, you're probably dreadfully behind in your office pool, while guys like me cleaning the floor with your sad, measly brackets. Here's my secret. I found a bunch of March Madness tips at coke.com/alwaysready. It's too much work to watch college basketball throughout the year. So I just head over to coke.com/alwaysready and I get everything I need to know. I was actually at Walmart the other day picking up some Coca-Cola and Powerade and all sorts of supplies for this big March Madness weekend that I was having, and I heard about this website and found it to be incredibly helpful. It's got all the stats and pointers that you don't usually know off the top of your head when you're filling out your bracket. So not only did I get some delicious Coca-Cola and Powerade, I also got a major leg up on everyone else in my office. So in your face, Soren. Goes to show that when you pick Coca-Cola and Powerade at Walmart, you'll always be ready for tip-off. So head over to Walmart and gear up to watch all the games with Coca-Cola and Powerade. Get in on the March Madness action by visiting coke.com/alwaysready. That's coke.com/alwaysready. Support for today's show comes from Squarespace. So I know you all have creative outlets outside of obsessively listening to the Cracked podcast. So whatever that outlet may be, if you have writing that you want to showcase, photography, short films, it's imperative that you have an eye-seducing website so people can find your stuff and give you all the money. And there's no better place to create that platform than Squarespace. They have tons of beautiful templates that look cooler than just about anything on the internet. And there's nothing to code or patch or upgrade ever. And if you ever have a problem, it doesn't matter how technical or trivial, Squarespace's award-winning 24/7 customer support can help you with any problem. Trust me, guys, you're going to want to start your free trial today at squarespace.com and enter offer code CRACKED to get 10% off your first purchase. Again, that's squarespace.com and enter offer code CRACKED for 10% off your first purchase and a free domain.
Did you read about the town in the former Yugoslavia? I believe it's not Croatia. But anyway, I think it was in Verge or Vice. But
they made all the fake news.
Yeah, the town that made all the fake news.
Yeah.
It's you're just like, this is amazing.
Yeah.
Like, it's just a town. It's totally capitalism. Yeah. These guys, all of a sudden they're driving around in BMWs and stuff because they're making fake news for Americans.
That is amazing.
And it's got, and there's no political agenda. They're just trying to make money.
Can we make this TV show already? Fake newspaper?
Because whether globalization pans out or not, there's still the ability to globally reach people with information from wherever. So you can go anywhere and just be like, you're poor enough and disconnected enough that you don't care about us fucking this segment of the earth. Well, we'll pay you to do that.
The way that it's evolved is, it's like, I mean, we always laugh about like how if people were angry, they would write letters to each other. And the idea that you have to wait so long for a response to something, and then so we just got, you know, we took forever to get information, and then the second we could get all the information, it was like, great, and then it's like, now the downside is like, what is the actual information? Like, right. Now we don't even know the information.
It's just all the information.
One of my favorite sketches we've never run about that concept is like, in Game of Thrones universe, how does any average person know what the fuck is going on?
Yeah. Right.
Like, a banner has to come through him and be like, this person was poisoned. Now he is the new leader. Yeah. Everyone swear fealty.
Right.
Like, I don't care.
They have pigeons, right? A pigeon flies by. Yeah. You're like, oh, I got the news.
You send like 15 and be like, please God, one of them. Please God.
Yeah, and just before getting off Boston, I was also just thinking, or struck kind of, because the thing that kicked it off is a bunch of neighborhoods in Southie were torn down in order to, I think, make room for Logan. Or no, to make room for the high-rises. And then a bunch of the neighborhoods in northern Boston where the black families lived were torn down to make room for Logan Airport. And I was just thinking that in Chicago, like, Chicago's going through a tough time right now. And they just spent the last 20 years tearing down the Cabrini Green, like, housing projects.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like, what do you think happens? Like, you just in your head, just put the numbers together and go, okay, so where do they go?
Exactly.
Yeah. Where do they go? And then how do they feel? Are they furious? Do they want to get revenge against somebody? Like, they're completely displaced. Maybe they've been living in that area forever and their family was all together and now their family's all blown apart. Like, there's just so many things that go into displacing people.
If people don't know Cabrini Green, it was in the 70s the setting of Good Times, and then by the early 90s the setting of Candyman. So that's
well, that says it all right there.
There you go.
Pretty good.
To me, it's just strange. Like, well, it's not going well, so let's blow it up. Why don't you just fix it? Throw some more money in there and fix it.
It's the same thing with the reason why there's a Muslim ban. The idea that you are dropping bombs in neighborhoods to try to hit targets that you're going to miss a good amount of the time and kill, like, and you don't think that's going to come home to roost? There's not going to be people who are like, hey, guess who I hate? since America killed everyone in my neighborhood, I've had a bit of a beef with them.
And it's incredible, our ability to build, like, rationalizing structures.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a lot of things have a lot of nuance, and I try to see the other side's arguments, but it's funny, or it's not funny, haha. But in, I think, the Oregon KKK episode, there were all these elaborate, intelligently crafted, articulate arguments for why we need to riot to support rights or whatever, and there's no way to not boil it down to, how dare you tell us not to own people?
Right.
You can't divorce it from that. So it's like, you're saying with homeless displacement or the displacement of the poor, you sort of have to at least sit down and admit to yourself, well, I don't care where they go and I don't care if they freeze to death. If that's your stance, let's start arguing from that. But like, don't be like, I don't think about where they'll go. Let's just demolish this thing.
What?
Okay, then you want them to go somewhere else and you don't care about the consequences. Right. Is that fine? Okay. Yeah. Right.
Well, I feel like they just did that in LA with Skid Row. Skid Row is just astonishing. Yeah. If you ever want to see what's happened to this country, drive down Skid Row here.
My girlfriend worked there for 3 years.
She loved it. It's mind-boggling, though, to see what's happened and how many people live in tents. But then they blew it up at one point and they made everyone move to other places. Yeah. And all of a sudden there are little Skid Rows everywhere. And you're like,
and
well,
they keep
that's
dispersing
not,
those, too.
That's not an answer. What do you think's going to happen?
It's like blowing up the whale. And you're like, why are there little whale pieces everywhere?
Dude, totally. It is whale splash. Explosion. It is going, look, we'll just blow up the problem. Well, now there's little whale pieces. My God! What is it going
to
take?
You have to blow all of those up.
Oh, boy.
Just a quick footnote here. Actual footnote. I've since realized that my footnote section should be called endnotes, since footnotes are generally scattered throughout the middle of the text. Anyways, Michael said it's similar to a whale explosion. If you haven't seen the video online or don't know what that story is referring to, there's a Dollop episode about it. A sperm whale carcass washed up on the shore in Oregon, my birth state, getting a lot of good publicity in this episode. And the guy who would normally handle it was on a hunting trip. The guy who was there decided he was going to put a half ton of dynamite inside the whale carcass and next to the whale carcass to make it disintegrate. And instead of disintegrating in a puff of smoke, like he apparently had expected, huge chunks of rotting whale meat flew into the air and landed on everything within a 1 mile radius. One guy's car was literally smashed by a 3 foot large chunk of whale that had been flung a quarter mile from the explosion. There was like shattered glass everywhere. Anyways, it's a great episode of The Dollop. At one point, Dave says, this is the story of America. And I think it is a great metaphor for the always brilliant, never hopelessly befucked decision-making process that steers our great nation. Back to the show.
I also love the idea of not spending money on it. So you spend more money on policing and prison and cleaning. And like, you're spending that money anyway. Just do it at the beginning where you can do some good.
Penny wise, dollar foolish.
There's been those occasional studies that at least in small populations have shown, like, you know, it's actually cheaper to just pay for every homeless person in your town to have like a small studio apartment and food stamps or whatever.
Just think about it.
And they're like, but we don't want to.
Right.
Right.
It seems unfair. Everyone would become homeless. Really? You'd want to live in just a studio apartment provided by the government?
It's not an ambition removing program.
Yeah. Right. I'd rather live in a world where we sandblast urine and shit off the front of a building.
Right.
Okay. Well, that seems weird.
All right, cool. Yeah. That works too.
They found in like every case, just giving people money is like the best thing for solving the problem. But people are like, nah, we don't know what they'll do with it. They didn't work for that.
Well, maybe they won't steal.
I don't know why. We should just stop having president. We should just have a program. We could come up with a computer program that we could keep an eye on.
Oh, dude, that's right around the corner.
That we could keep an eye on.
Oh,
right.
Boy.
Right? I'm talking about an independent. I'm not talking about one that the two parties put in place. Like, we preserve Bernie Sanders' brain and we make it a computer. And, you know, like, we can get this done.
Just vote
or Gary Johnson. Again, that guy. To preserve that mind and just make it learn Aleppo.
It was the perfect election for the libertarians to actually do something, and then they crank out Gary Johnson.
Well, that's the problem, though. I think that was the issue, that the libertarians didn't have a spotlight forever so they could perform any dance they wanted, and then all of a sudden the spotlight was on and Gary Johnson was like, I forgot my tap shoes. I'll just clap.
you mentioned just offhandedly the Oregon KKK episode. I'm sure most people don't realize
that. Who knew about that?
Yeah. As I call it in my household, the reason that now I will never achieve my dream of moving to Oregon. It's like the most beautiful state. I've always wanted to live there. My girlfriend's a social worker. She's like, we're not moving to Klan State. Fuck you.
Yeah.
So can you just explain what that
was? So at one point, Oregon, you know, was a territory, and then it became a state. And around that time, they just decided that they should make a rule that no black people should live there. So it's the only state that has ever made a law that black people can't live in the state.
Well, there's been many strong suggestions, but like an explicit law. We're willing to say,
A bunch of people sat down and voted and said, this is not.
No, they put it on the state sign.
And so, you know, that really structured how that society works. And it's still extremely segregated. There's not a lot of black people that live there up in the Northwest. Northwest is a big white supremacist area.
Yeah. I just saw the movie Green Room.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, Green Room.
It's a documentary.
Weren't you watching it thinking, man, someone's been around this a lot.
Sure.
In this world.
Absolutely.
Yeah, my beloved cousin also lives in Portland. When I visit her, we were riding bikes around, and I'm like, I love this neighborhood with all like these weird curlicue streets. And she's like, oh, yeah, that's because the Klan built it all confusing so that a black person would be too intimidated to wander through that neighborhood.
Let's get a lift. Let's get out of here. I don't want to walk anymore. I don't want to walk on these racist, confusing streets.
Jesus. So that's like known up there? They're like, oh, yeah, and that's where
it's known that there's still like, white supremacist
enclaves. Do you want the KKK route or the regular route? Which one are you after?
Jesus.
Well, that's what's funny, is it has become, obviously, so progressive if you stop, 9 out of 10 people on the street, but it's still staggeringly white.
Well, if you get outside of the city, Oregon's a very different place.
That, my experience is, yeah, mostly Portland, yeah. So I shouldn't talk out of turn.
Yeah.
Portland's really an island amongst...
Right. It's like New Orleans and Louisiana.
I don't know. Yeah. Portland plus your podcast episode was enough. I'm out. Also, that you have to do self-serve gas in Oregon.
Right.
You can't.
Oh, or, they're like New Jersey?
I'm sorry, you can't do self-serve gas, yeah.
Yeah, that
you have
is,
to use an attendant.
I'm not a fan of that. That I didn't know that. That's awful news.
It's just like,
is that ever not awkward? You're like, I know all the things to do your right. job. Right. Everything. I've done all this. I actually have notes for you.
Yeah. They
say, you're doing two things wrong, dummy.
I'll need your pen to type in the debit.
Sweet.
It's like having a law that you can only have human signs, yeah. no actual yeah. signs. With,
can you yeah, make eye contact signs. With me while it authorizes? It's important for me.
89, huh? It's odd. What do you do? Things are good, huh? There's a lot of people getting 87s. My buddy's a 91er, so anyway, cool ride. Can I lay down in the back seat? Well, this fills up automatically because there's a button that I just push.
That's right. The reason those guys existed was because you used to have to hold it.
Yeah.
Right.
No, then someone came up with a fucking button. And they were like, oh, yeah. It clicks.
Yeah.
Ted, you're fired.
The other episode that was mind-melting to me was the Enron episode, which I thought I knew what Enron was.
I think we all did until I started reading about it, and I was just like going,
everyone's seen the smartest guys in the room, exactly. And I thought, I was like, yeah. So when he said Enron, I was like, okay, I kind of know this one, just so you know. And then he's going through it, I was like, huh? Same thing?
Because they weren't the smartest guys in the room.
No, they were just the shadiest dudes in the world.
And the most self-deluding in a way.
And again, it was an opportunity where nobody had really just gone that full bullshit.
Yeah. Totally.
Right.
But yeah, amazing insight into how you justify shit to yourself. Because the most amazing thing that I didn't get from the documentary that I got from the episode was all the shit that Ken Lay still says or said. Ha ha ha. I'm a godly man and grandma shouldn't have invested her discretionary fund if she didn't want to take it away.
Yeah,
dude, right. Just fucking like admit the thing that everyone knows you did that you got caught for.
Can't do it.
Although I was looking up on Wikipedia, I read his Wikipedia page and they were like, he died in the mountains of Oregon. His body was immediately...
descended upon by ravens.
His body was immediately cremated and buried in an undisclosed location in the mountains, which like...
just so people won't just literally on it weekly.
Dude, Morrison gets graffiti.
Yeah. Right.
I mean...
Imagine.
I assumed it was because he faked his death, because it was so convenient that he died.
Oh, you think?
He died like 3 months after he got sentenced.
But that's what's crazy is like... I could see that because I'm never surprised by like, oh, guess what? Some rich asshole somehow got away with it and still has a bunch of the money. But I could also honestly believe that someone sitting in prison alone, finally reckoning with that moment of shit, I did do that shit. Heart attack. Like,
no,
that,
he was on vacation with his family.
What? I thought he died in prison.
No,
he died
on vacation in Colorado. In the mountains.
All right, he's D.B. Cooper.
He's out there listening to this right now.
Yeah, he's listening to this podcast.
But yeah, so what? One of the first crazy details that I hadn't known was that he basically stacked the deck by being a member of the Nixon administration. Of course, it has to be the Nixon administration.
He was one of the first,
worst people.
He was one of the first guys to come in and sort of dictate what energy policy would be in the future. Mm-hmm. So he set it all up for himself to take advantage of.
There was all these laws in place, which Republicans or, you know, libertarians will tell you is just a way of making things inefficient. But, you know, there were laws in place because people need these things. They need gas. They need electricity.
The thing about the no regulation crowd is it's such a stupid argument because it's like saying there should be no rules. Why don't you go to a school and run a school with no rules and see how it goes? Rules exist for a reason. Right. Regulations, you need some, you don't need others. Does some hurt business? Yeah, work on it. But no rules is Enron.
Right.
That's Enron. And no rules is about what we're about to see. It's the housing crisis. It's the savings and loan crisis. It's going to happen all over again because you're doing no rules.
They actually did that in a school in Boston.
No rules?
No rules, yeah.
Well, yeah, like a hippie school.
It's very simple to just know that regulations is something that you need. And when you hear someone on TV saying, I don't want any regulations, the American people don't want any regulations, just go, oh, regulations. We need those.
Right.
Yeah, this man's lying to me because he said we don't need regulations.
But if that person says it, I should be able to go to a gas station and just start squirting gas on them.
Well, no, the attendant has to do it. You can't do it.
We have to have rules. No, it was funny. I was listening to that episode right as the thing was in the news about how Trump was like rolling back all these regulations.
That's why
people were just like, yeah, it's going to be great. And it's not like this ethos that drove Enron was like punished out of people. It's like still the idea that Trump is deregulating, which is, as we'll talk about, is the whole thing that led to Enron, was just being like, no, they can do whatever they want. The fact that he's doing that is the reason the stock market's going through the roof.
Is and the greed is good shit, like that the ability of so many people who got to the higher levels of Enron to sit down and think their way through convincing themselves that like, fuck off, asshole, I'm making money, it's the American goddamn way. If you get in my way, you're the asshole.
There are psychopaths in all facets of our country. So a psychopath, if you think about it, will be attracted to that business where he can just fuck everything and make as much money as he can. Why wouldn't psychopaths be driven? Right. Power and money.
They're classically bored, so it's like increasing risk.
Right.
Yeah.
So you're, when you take away regulation, you're giving those people a free holiday to do whatever they want.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just feel like
it's an exciting future.
The Big Short 2 is going to be real good. Though.
Yeah.
Oh, that thing. Yeah. By the way, that's a coming.
They're already writing it.
That's a dollop that's coming because I've already figured out what it is. Nice.
It's really amazing. I don't think I fully appreciated how full of shit Enron was, that they were essentially just making up money.
Just lying and making up, like, it's kind of mind-boggling they got to do it for so long, and it was just all bullshit.
How easy and unsophisticated it was.
Right.
You assume they know so much business magic that they're shifting things around, but they were just telling people, no, we have more money than we said. Get out of my office.
The CEO was asking Wall Street, what would it take for our stock price to like stay where it is or go up a little bit? They would give him a number, and he'd be like, there, that's what we're making.
Okay, yeah, we'll do that. What? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, we did it.
That's ours.
We made that many Enrons.
That's how many we did. We did that many.
And separating gas, like making some gas be worth more than other gas, it's just like, what?
Yeah. Right, yeah, yeah. Yeah. No, it's this thing called mark to market, which I do think it's important to try and explain it.
It's very hard.
But it's also, like, Fortune magazine rated them as, like, the most ethical company in 2000. Like, put them on the top five list of, like, the greatest boards or, you know, the people who are supposed to be regulating.
Well, because highly respected auditor Arthur Anderson gave them a gold seal every goddamn year.
But, like, they should have, like, when you hear that they're doing mark-to-market, all that means is that every time they close a deal for, like, here, we're going to... There's this deal they did with Blockbuster that is really easy to understand why it doesn't make any sense. They said, okay, we're going to work with Blockbuster to provide streaming movies to houses across America for the next 20 years. They would still be essentially providing our video on demand. But this was at a time when, like, they didn't have the capabilities to do that. It was a crazy idea. But what mark to market means is rather than just counting the money as it came in, as people paid for it, they would be like, okay, so over 20 years, that'll be worth $5 billion. So we made $5 billion this year.
Right.
And that they just imagined up that money, and that money counted on the books.
It's called
them.
The Secret. It's manifesting.
I always think about, when I hear business, dude, I try to think about, what if I did that? What if I just came home and was like, honey, we made $300 million this year.
Right.
How? I just sold a TV show.
Right.
I'm going to give you 40 orgasms this next week. Yeah, it's early projections.
Right. But they become real somehow.
Yeah, because
they,
as soon as...
convinced reality that they exist.
Regulations, they got rid of them. The government agreed to that for gasoline, which is not something you should do. And then off they went.
Why did the government agree to that stuff?
Well, and now they're trying to do it to the internet again, and that's going to suck balls.
Oh, yeah. But there's a couple of ways they do it. They first, they wine and dine them, right? And they make them feel like they're part of the party. a lot of those guys will be working in the building or nearby, and they're part of the show, right? And
yeah.
Then,
Kenny boy.
And then the other thing is they set it up before they leave. Ken Lay works for the government. He gets rid of all these regulations, and then he goes out to a business that can exploit them.
Yeah. Right,
like,
exactly.
That's, I mean, that's just, what our government
is. It really is the retirement package of government. Go to a business where you know the laws that you've worked on and can exploit.
Right. Week. Yeah.
Yeah, that's what he did. He left the Nixon administration and went to all these power companies and was like, hey, I think deregulation might be coming down the pike, because he had just made sure that it was coming down the pike and then profited off of that. Gareth, I think you said it was like being a meteorologist and also you make the weather. So like, yeah, you're going to be fucking good at your job. You're just like determining what happens. Hey guys, just wanted to jump in here real quick to say the other reason they're able to do this is because, as Gareth was alluding to when he said Kenny boy, Enron was extremely well connected with the Bush family. George W. Bush called Ken Lay Kenny Boy, and the George W. Bush White House actively fought for policies that would help Enron eventually rob people and kill at least one person with the rolling blackouts in California during the year 2000. Because of deregulation, they were basically allowed to overload the line carrying power between Northern and Southern California and then price gouge their customers when they needed power, and all the manipulation of the power where the goal was to make Enron money rather than to supply people with power ended up causing blackouts, rolling blackouts, if you remember that term from the news, if you were born back then. And that's a problem, because while we might think of it as a luxury or talk about it like it's a luxury, anyone who's had their power out for more than 24 hours can tell you that power is sort of a basic human necessity these days. And in a heat wave, people die if they don't have air conditioning. Usually there are rules against price gouging and intentionally overloading power lines, obviously. And those rules are called regulations. And deregulation is when you take away those rules and trust giant corporations to just, you know, use their judgment to do what's best. Anyways, Enron was behind the scenes causing these blackouts in projects that they called shit like Death Star, because they thought it was funny that they were being evil. And, you know, people were like, wait, what the fuck's going on? Why do huge chunks of California keep losing power? We're a major Western nation. Our power doesn't go out unless there's a major disaster. People died because of these blackouts. So they asked President Bush about it, and Bush says California is experiencing these rolling blackouts because they haven't fully deregulated their power market. They're not giving Enron enough room to work, is his answer. This goes on for 2 years until someone finally convinces the state government to reintroduce those regulations, and when the regulations come back, the blackouts stop. And that's kind of what I'm talking about, why I wanted to talk about Enron. I was struck by just the sheer balls on these guys to continuously screw the vast majority of people while claiming that what they're doing is in our best interest. It's just staggering. But anyways, that's what I'm referring to when I asked how they're able to do that. At one point, in the smartest guys in the room, an expert called the Bush family's relationship to Enron the single most important relationship between an American corporation and a presidential family. And the vice president, Dick Cheney, had 6 meetings with Enron prior to their collapse, 6 meetings in Washington, D.C. And when the media asked what went on in those meetings, as is their right as the media, Cheney invoked something called executive privilege, which basically means that it's in the nation's best interest that the happenings in that meeting don't get out. And, you know, he's probably right insofar as the continued existence of the nation involves us not storming the gates of him and the other handful of people in Washington with flamethrowers. Anyways, felt like that was some necessary context. Back to the episode. And so Ken Lay, this guy, George H.W. Bush was like his really good friend.
Kenny Boy.
Then W called him Kenny Boy.
Kenny Boy.
Even though Ken Lay died like months after he was convicted and like it was the height of, you know, the scandal, George H.W. Bush still went to his funeral and like.
So this is something that's exactly parallel today. They invite in the companies right. to write the legislation and then they rewrite it like they do yep. it. And then they send it out. It happened with Obamacare.
Right.
Obamacare was written by insurance people, health insurance people that came in and wrote it. And it happened with Enron. And it just happens over and over again.
They get like approval. They get like a pass. They get like a pass on the bill where they're like, this is a red flag.
And then people are like, regulations are bad. You're like, fucker, these guys wrote it. Right. Yeah. Some regulations are helping them. Some are right. bad for them. But
wait, Obamacare was written by insurance companies?
Yeah, Max Baucus is the senator whose office wrote Obamacare. And right before it started, he hired a woman who was a vice president of an insurance company. Wow. She came in, she wrote Obamacare, and then off she went. Huh. I mean, look, that's how our government operates. That's just what it is. It's like when I right. see all these people being upset about Trump, I'm like, Trump is the logical evolution
right.
of our corrupt right. and ridiculous system of government.
Also, right. if it wasn't Trump, it would be coming soon.
Right.
The Trump was coming. It came early and crazy, but it yeah. was in the next 4 to 8, we were going to have Hulk Hogan in the office
or something. Yeah,
without a doubt. Honestly. Yeah.
Anyone who's like, what are they talking about? Trump being a person of the lower class people who are getting exploited. Trump was part of a World Wrestling Entertainment plotline. He like speaks in
great.
The language of lower class. Like America just doesn't realize they have a class system. So
yeah,
like,
he's got
don't.
Great lower yeah. body strength though. If you watch those clips, the way he some of these wrestlers are twice his size and he's oh. taking them down.
Figure you know? 4 on the Undertaker. Yeah.
yeah. Well, yeah,
very
the
big
whole
deal.
The whole campaign was a wrestling plot line.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
it was amazing to watch.
Yeah. yeah. And now McMahon is in the government. Perfect.
We're living in a wrestling.
Oh man, we are in the we are in yeah, we're just like honestly, imagine someone gives you this script. You're like, come on, buddy. I love crazy right. swing for the fences shit. Come on. We gotta sell this.
I feel like House of Cards lost some of its punch immediately.
Oh yeah.
No, we just wrote an article.
I think
didn't,
Matt and Trey South Park, which is what I guess their last names are.
Yes.
Just
Matt
said
and Trey
like,
South Park.
They live together.
Oh, we're abandoning the Mr. Garrison as Trump thing because I don't, what could he fucking say that's more offensive than
that's
possible.
Yeah. No, you can't, he you can't parody him. Like
so
it's just
if you like the SNL debate sketches were really callbacks. They were just reminding you of things that you saw.
In reality.
In reality.
Yeah.
You know, there was some, I mean, obviously they're very inventive, but a lot of the stuff in those debate ones were literally just things that Trump had said or done.
Yeah.
Or Clinton, because the whole yeah. thing was such a circus.
Yeah, I'm certainly with this vibe you guys are putting out. It's the system as a whole. It's completely,
for
it's
sure.
the money interest just as fact. And yeah. I like historical long view and like human nature arguments. So part of me just wonders if it's not, look, any organization that's a power structure, who do you think by and large makes their way to the top? The monkey man that is more willing to fuck other people and grab
yes.
more.
It's
the person who's nice and polite ends up in a middling or lower position because you care about other people's lives.
It's literally traveling. I think it all the time when I travel. The person who whines and bitches and goes up to the gate agent and asks for extra shit is going to
yeah.
board first. And the rest of us who are embarrassed by that are like, no, I'll do the honest way. And you're going to get a middle seat and be like, God damn it.
Yeah.
But that person's loving the front.
But yeah. to think that like even the system of government that was built to try and combat that natural human instinct. Like, checks and balances is a great pitchable premise for
sure.
a government. It cannot, over the long term, like, withstand the self-interest of psychopathic assholes, like,
because
just chipping away at it, chipping
yeah.
away.
Yeah, greed is a strong emotion. Like, it's they're going to take as much money as they can. If you're
right.
trying to beat your last record, like, right. of holding your breath, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
you have to, like, outdo it.
So,
and they'll do anything to outdo
and,
it.
And there's bubbles right now that exist from this greed. One of the bubbles is used cars. So, you know, a lot of these people lost their credit in their homes and stuff, so they couldn't buy new cars. So the explosion of the used car companies, you know, the, what are
E-fax
they?
Or
the CarMax. And
yeah, yeah.
All of a sudden you saw an explosion of those. Well, that was because people didn't have credit. So then they started getting those loans that people used to get for houses with the balloon loans and the other things. So that just shifted to used cars. So that's going to explode.
Yeah.
There's also annuities and life insurance, which is how the Dodgers, when the Dodgers were bought, they were bids for like $1 billion. And all of a sudden this company went in and went, $1.5 billion. And everyone's like, what the fuck just happened? And they're like, we're throwing it on the table. And everyone's right. Like, where'd that money come from? And so I kept looking around. I finally found someone investigated and found out that when you used to sell life insurance or annuities, you would have to have a separate bank keep a percentage of a deposit in that bank for you to sell that life insurance policy. So there had to be a certain amount to cover in case something goes wrong, like a disaster. And so what they did was they just said, and they got rid of all those regulations. So now you didn't have to keep a certain amount of money in there. And on top of that, you could buy the other bank. So it's called shadow banks. And so no one knows how much of a percentage.
That's the term's bad.
Also, all the assholes somehow know it instinctively because, like, all the secret operations for Enron were like Operation Fuck Grandma. They had terrible evil names.
Operation Rape California.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
So, anyway, that's a thing where, and then all of a sudden annuities and life insurance started getting sold like crazy. All of a sudden you're getting things in the mail saying, hey, do you want it? It was the same thing as with when they wanted you to get a mortgage and credit. It's the exact same thing. Now it's life insurance. So they don't have that money to back it up. So if there is a disaster or a pandemic or some sort of thing, the economy is going to collapse too.
Sure. And well, of course, as we've seen happen in other industries, the insurance company at that point will say, look, we're this huge corporation employing all these people. How could we have foreseen? We don't have the money. Like, what can we do?
No.
Yeah. And they won't admit that what they're doing is fucked until it's completely kicking the fences because they have
a yacht and they have a boat. And the thing is like America used to be, Beverly Hills was one of the richest counties in Westchester and near San Francisco, Marin County. Now it's the seven counties around Washington, D.C. are the most expensive places to live because the money is all shifted to D.C.
Oh, wow.
And that just sort of shows how
fucked up everything
is. But
it's going to be great when we go there with our flamethrowers and our devices to lay down in these palatial spreads, you know, nice couches we don't belong on with our grubby fingers.
Well, it's going to be like when our troops went into Saddam Hussein's palace.
Oh, yeah. Right. It's going to be great.
Wiped Cheeto dust on the white shit.
Yeah, as Mitch McConnell's like, no, that was a gift from the senator. What's that, Mitch? Let me just snap this pool cue in half and beat you at the end for a minute while I drink your champagne I can't pronounce.
Yeah, there's a great New Yorker article from earlier this year about Silicon Valley billionaires who are becoming survivalists stocking up on shotgun shells.
Oh, they're
and
like,
shit.
Property we're in New so Zealand. Rich, people are going to come for this eventually, We got it.
They know. Yeah, they know.
But you can't buy hands. You can't buy hands, gentlemen.
There are ideas to build a floating island out in the ocean that has.
I'll swim
low...
it. We'll swim. We'll get there how we get to Mars. We'll procreate en route.
Free Whitey Bulger. Get him to take a crack at Barron Trump's elementary school.
Whitey Bulger is what I call my boners.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. I knew that and was telling you to free. Yeah.
Similarly went on a 35-year rampage of terror.
Fair enough.
Recently brought to justice, right? Portrayed by Johnny Depp in the film.
It's a resemblance, I'll say that.
What a terrifying looking likeness.
It's good. It finally, him as Madame Tussaud is a human. Madame Tussaud's laughing all the way to the bank. They're like, we played the long game with the Johnny Depp statue.
Well,
he is it now.
The really weird thing is I call my boner the black mass.
We should talk.
I just call mine Doug.
Yeah.
Any overall trends that I've sort of noticed after listening to the dollop is that the North is way more racist than the North wants to admit to being, I think, with Oregon and Boston. Are there kind of conclusions you've come to after 200 episodes?
Oh, yeah, because we're big on, like, what are myths of American history told as a platitude, and the opposite is true.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, as the person who never knows what is happening and has just heard all the information, to me, it is just race. The amount of stuff that comes back to race, the amount of things that are based on race, the lack of ability to deal with racism and slavery and all those things, and the way that things that seem so crazy in the 1800s, if you really boil them down, are just like, it's almost like we black mirrored the 1800s in a way. Right. Like there's just these splinter effects, and what human reaction can be very similar, which is that it can be, you know, persuaded to believe crazy shit And we're still doing that. And we don't notice it because we're living in it, but...
And Dave, when you're researching, do you ever, is race an area of interest for you? Or will you be researching a story and be like, God damn, it's racism again?
No. I mean, sometimes
popping up again.
Sometimes I don't want to have anything to do with racism. I'm just like, fuck, we're back here. There's a guy that I wanted to, there were a couple ones I want, like live is, I think, a place you can't do the racism stuff, live shows.
Yeah.
Because I wanted to do one in New York, and then I started reading the quotes, and I was like, God damn it, really? We're back here?
I'm not going to say this in any context in front of people.
As you lock eyes with the black guy up front, how you doing, sir? Just this man said this, just so you know.
But I think for me, it's class, like you said earlier. I think that to me was the surprising thing is the reason they started sending prisoners to Australia is because we had our revolution and we didn't let them anymore. They were sending prisoners here. They sent over purposefully a lower class, very poor group of people from England to be workers and to be disposable workers that would die working. And those people have never gotten a leg up as far as, well, the American dream. There's no fucking American dream for those people. Right. You don't get to fucking, maybe one out of 100 does, but for the most part, you're just fucked. And you live a very poor life and you just try to get by. And the classism that exists, which I think you're really seeing on display right now from, particularly it's come very ugly from liberals, I think, in this election season. Those are the things you don't really look out for or realize from our history. No one taught you that, you know, Georgia tried to originally be a non-slave state.
Yeah.
And the fighting against that was extraordinary. They're like, right. No, we want, because
they
we want.
They got bribed with peaches.
Yes, because they wanted those poor white people to be able to make a living. Right. And they saw that if slavery came in, then they would be fighting against the black people for those jobs, if you could even call it that, but for that labor, right? So there's just always been
a class. But what about owning people? Oh, I abstain on the issue. I just want my job.
But it's always been classism, and classism is...
Yeah. And in fact, it's interesting that we have then, in not too distant history, such a propaganda movement against communism, the cornerstone idea of which is, well, let's look at distribution of wealth.
Yeah.
It almost became un-American to examine whether distribution of wealth is fair.
Oh, right. Yeah.
So there became this huge class stratification, and it's, until I think recently, it might be starting to change, but it's unpatriotic to, like, even think about it or talk about it. Because what are you,
steps
goddamn
on
communist?
The American dream.
What are you saying?
Steps on the American dream.
That moment where that kid, because let's face it, millennials, just the most fucked generation in American history, they have a different view of socialism that has never been around. And when that kid stood up on CNN and asked Nancy Pelosi, like, you know, about 50% of my generation believe in socialism, blah, blah, and she said, we're capitalists. Like, her brain couldn't even comprehend that that could be a thing that someone else is thinking.
Her eyes got wider somehow.
She was just like, we're capitalists, I have $107 million. Yeah. Like, she just couldn't fathom it. But sorry, if you fuck people over, that's what comes.
Yeah.
It's just what comes.
Yeah, we did an episode about class and... just having grown up in the country and, you know, not read much about class in America, it was like looking through the Matrix still. I still think there's like very little class awareness. Like there's this guy who like wrote this theory of class in America. He like broke out. I think it was like ruling class is like the top 0.01%. Then there's upper class. Then there's middle class, lower class, and people in poverty. And he was saying that each class is only aware of the one directly above them and directly below.
Right.
And they shit on the ones below them.
Right.
And
aspire they think, to the one
aspire,
above.
Yeah. They aspire, but also like talk shit about the ones above them because they think they're smug.
Yeah.
And they don't even know the other ones exist. So
fascinating.
Yeah.
What's crazy is also the ruling class could fit in like this room.
Yeah.
It's like, that's what's going to be so satisfying when we get there with our flamethrowers and our swords and our bombs. Right. Well, and we'll go, this is going to be like an afternoon. I packed for 2 weeks. It's going to be a cinch.
But the class thing,
warfare, class picnic. Yeah. This is easy.
The class thing is obscured by racism, right?
Exactly.
I mean, that's what gets it all mixed up, and then people can't see the classes because there's that.
And that's what's staggering, I think, and somewhat unique to American culture is there's other cultures where the block of people who are in poverty or dire poverty are uniquely aware of it as an issue of class and financial distribution. But we still have a healthy number of poor people who think it's about race or immigrants, and it's just like a diversion to keep it away from like there's people way more directly just keeping the money from you than like your immigrant neighbor.
I get it.
Right. Racism is probably mostly still around because of how insanely valuable it's been to those really, really rich people who kind of make the rules, you know?
For sure. Well, and they can prove to you that smoking will kill you. Right. It's hard to prove that race, like you can't give, it's, there's never going to be a moment where people are going to admit, these people who hold on to it so dearly, that, okay, fine, racism has a huge downside if you look at the statistics.
Yeah. Well, it's funny to see a lot of black people say after they watch the liberals crying on election night, like, welcome to our world.
Yeah. Right. Oh, yeah.
This is how we've always felt.
Yep. Yeah. Yes, that was an amazing moment. I mean, that was like that was like the Alfred Hitchcock pull back in the hallway shot for white people. That was like the whole time.
It's not bad that you now are aware of racism, but where the fuck have you been?
Hey, how you doing? We got a bunch of seats at this party. Yeah, sit down, asshole. Did you get the Evite?
Anything else you guys wanted to cover?
Are you hopeful for the future? You seem like you're hopeful for the future.
What makes you think that?
It comes, your optimism comes
because
across.
Because you have a, you say like, I think that this can be worked out and that eventually the country will all come together and
I'm just blah, blah, blah nonsense,
as I call it.
I'm just a big believer in that. Well, I never believe anything. I mean, like, there's very few core convictions I have. I'm constantly examining, re-examining. And the other side of the coin is like, instinctively, my gut tells me that in my lifetime, the world will probably end. But I have to logically look at
there
the other side and be like, people have felt that way throughout history. What are the odds that statistically you're, quote unquote,
how'd
like,
you get so lucky
to be around for, no, really, this bullshit storm is so big that the earth is destroyed. Well, maybe it feels that way to you, but the world will struggle on. And if you look at over hundreds of thousands of years, and not for every segment of population, but if you averaged everyone's quality of life, like, sure, over 10,000 years, it's gotten better, I guess, in a lot of demonstrable ways. So that's, like, as optimistic as I'll be. Mm-hmm. It's like, if we are still alive in a million years, I can't imagine it's worse than now, like I would hope.
What is going to be great is when the big tidal wave of fire is coming down upon all of us, and we'll go, we were lucky.
Yeah.
We were the chosen ones.
I also am totally pro, like, globalization, despite the negative sides I see in the short term. Like, I see that side of the argument.
Well, it's
I
not,
think it helps.
It's not so much globalization as it is responsible globalization, right? I mean, there's a way to do it and a way not to do it. And I think the way we've done it particularly is a way not to do it.
We're absolutely the black and white version in the infomercial that's like, ugh, I can't keep all this Tupperware in the cabinet.
I think Dean Baker, is an economist, always says, well, if trade is fair, if all these, you know, packs we're making are fair, why don't we have it for doctors? Why can't doctors go to a school in Mexico, get a super cheap education that is accredited, and then teach?
Right.
Well, because they have the power, right? So it's just the poor workers who get fucked. But there are plenty of things that you can do fair trade on that are not being done. Why is that? Because it's not fair in reality. So there, you know, globalization is fine. Globalization is inevitable. You just have to do it responsibly and take care of your people.
Okay, you brought me back to pessimism.
Get it.
But also, I will say, I see a lot of hope in the millennials.
I do too.
Think they're a pretty sweet generation.
I just don't know if we'll get there. Look, in my mind, what we're seeing right now is a battle, is the battle over climate change, which is Trump represents carbon, Trump represents gasoline. And everybody else doesn't realize we're at war with them yet. Right. And they know we're at war with them.
Right.
So they are now taking control. And it's what do they do now that they have control? Do they go authoritarian? Do they do this? Do they do that? But the millennials' views are something I never thought I would see. And it is the one thing that does give me hope.
They're all socialist vegetarians, I feel like.
Another person my age talks shit about him. I'm going to punch him in the fucking mouth.
They all saw Captain Planet growing up, or I guess I did. Even stuff after that. But my point is,
you're technically a millennial.
There's a delayed effect with culture brainwashing you with good things as well. You know what I mean? Like the awareness of you have to have a whole generation growing up taking it for granted that, oh, the earth can be destroyed and mm-hmm. we need to not do that. Those people are coming of age to start having a political voice now, and that's going to help.
I don't know if I'll give Captain Planet credit for all of that.
Fine. But I just mean, you know,
a lot
mean,
of it.
There's a point before which you don't mention that as a concept.
Right.
Like, no, they're polluting the river.
I definitely grew up on really rock stupid cartoons that like, had no political message. I grew up on Scooby-Doo.
But it's funny to watch what even the dumbest cartoons, who they make the villain is really culturally revealing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And there's a phase where it became like the plutocrat polluting the river. And I like that. I was like, that's a good target.
Yeah. Plutocrat.
Yeah, exactly.
There you go. Thank you. There's an episode of Transformers that I remembered seeing when I was like 4 or 5 that we covered on the site where the bad guys were from a town called Carbamistan.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
So wow.
That's what I... That's
more.
My excuse.
No more.
More of that, please.
There we go.
Guarantee you, voiced by 22-year-old white dude in his flip flops.
Yeah. Right. Cool.
All right, guys, that was our episode. Thanks to Dave and Gareth for doing it, and Michael Swaim, as always, my occasional co-host. Hope you enjoyed it and learned something. By the way, the 2000 magazine that rated Enron's board as one of the best in the country was not Fortune, it was Chief Executive Magazine. I was just looking through my extensive back catalog of chief executives and caught that, and I called my friend Chad, and I was like, Chad, you'll never guess what Chief Executive wrote about Enron. More like Enron. Anyways, on to some footnotes. We're going to link off to the Dollop, obviously, and some episodes of the Dollop, the Boston busing ones, the Oregon and the Ku Klux Klan one, the Dollop about Enron, and we'll also link off to the list of sources that they provide, which is something that we should totally do a better job of. We'll link off to an image of the 11 nations of America, the map kind of breaking out those different nations. And we'll link off to a U.S. News and World Report article that's about that photograph that I was talking about that's like a living political cartoon. It's called A Flag, A Busing Fight, and a Famous Photograph. The Boston busing crisis is really worth reading up on. We'll link off to the BBC documentary called Hyper-Normalization that Dave and Gareth brought up, and the article from BuzzFeed News, that's who wrote the article about how teens in the Balkans are duping Trump supporters with fake news. Turns out it's in Macedonia where they create all the fake news, and yeah, that it was BuzzFeed News. I feel like BuzzFeed should start having a thing in their URL where it's like bad.buzzfeed and like good.buzzfeed, because they do occasionally do some really great journalism. And we'll link off to the episode that we did about class in America and one of the articles we talked about in that episode where they talk about that theory of class stratification where one class only knows about the ones directly above and below them. And that's going to do it for us, guys. Thanks to engineer Brett, who you can follow on Twitter at Brett, R-A-D-E-R. You can follow me at Jack_O-B-R-I-E-N. And we'll be back next week with more podcasts. Talk to you then. Hey guys, I just wanted to thank Coca-Cola and Powerade, my two good friends, for sponsoring this episode of the Cracked Podcast. If you want to get all sorts of tips and pointers for filling out your bracket, head over to coke.com/alwaysready and be sure to head over to Walmart to pick pick up a 6-pack of Coca-Cola and an 8-pack of Powerade to get your NCAA March Madness tip-off party started right.
Hi, this is Gilbert Gottfried. Every week, my co-host Frank Santopadre and I take a fun look back at the movies, music, and TV shows we love and the performers we grew up watching. People like Dick Van Dyke.
I'm very impressed.
Adam West.
Thank you, Gilbert Grape.
Bruce Dern.
Well, thank you, sir. I much appreciate the intro.
Jessica Walter. Ron Liebman. Our pal, Dana Gould. Ira Glass.
Wow.
Matthew Broderick.
Thank you for that lengthy introduction.
Yeah, Bob Einstein.
What an introduction.
Welcome, our pal, Chevy Chase.
Hey, thank you, Gil.
Gilbert Gottfried's amazing colossal podcast, right here on Earwolf.
This has been an Earwolf production, executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Chris Bannon, and Colin Anderson. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.